And I'll spend a little time talking a little bit more about the equipment in our network and this. It seems like there's some interest in that. And we're running very good on time, so we'll have plenty for questions, or if anybody else would like to give some of your experiences in telemedicine, we'd love to hear them. So anyway, using teledentistry and health information technology to detect and treat early childhood caries in farm worker children. So early childhood caries, or cavities, are really a problem for low-income families. Children Head Start, the prevalence rate they're saying is anywhere from 40 to 60%. And of those low-income groups, the migrant kids are the worst. And that's because of a cultural practice called baby bottle tooth decay, where they put the baby to sleep with the bottle, and it can cause severe decay. You can see the prevalence rate here. Generally, in the general population, it's less than 5%, and disadvantaged low-income urban children about 20%, but almost 30% in farm worker children having this tooth decay. So in our migrant program, again, thinking of innovative practice, we actually do mobile dental programs. We take our equipment to the migrant Head Start programs, and we do them. There's several different sites in New York State that we do this in. We're talking about dental hygiene, exams, fluoride treatment, simple respirations on site with a dentist. They go every 6 months. And the good news about that, we got that prevalence rate down. We did a chart review of our kids a few years back in some of the bigger migrant Head Starts and found that that prevalence rate went from 60% to 22% with all that great prevention work. But a lot of this decay, it's really disgusting when you see a little three-year-old that's got pus pockets and no teeth. She's got no teeth, pus pockets through her mouth, fistulas and such. And that kind of treatment requires treatment in the operating room under general anesthesia. About 50% of our kids that go through our teledentistry program that we see with that have to go to the OR for treatment. So even though our mobile dental teams were out there doing all this great work and prevention, they still found those kids that needed this treatment, again, about half. So they referred them into a tertiary care center in Rochester, really, the University of Rochester, Eastman School, what's it called now? The oral something or other, Eastman, it's the Eastman Dental School, basically, treats these kids. And, like, they're one of the only Medicaid providers in New York State, so we're talking kids from Albany, you know, 200-300 miles east and north having to come to Rochester to get taken care of. And if they don't, you know, I don't know if you've all read about what could happen with kids with this disease, but, you know, they suffer from speech delay because it hurts. They're not eating right. They suffer nutritional problems because it hurts. It's pain. It's self-esteem as they get older, and there's gaps in their teeth from this decay. So treating baby teeth is important to do. So what we found when we did this chart review, of those kids that needed to be referred into Eastman or into a dentist that was doing nitrous for anesthesia, only about 15% of them were getting in. And then if they were migrants, they were just moving, and they would never get care. So again, the idea of having to come up with an innovative approach to solve this problem. So we did a collaboration. We never did apply for that funding, which I'm going to look find out about. But we did form a coalition with Eastman, ourselves, and the daycare centers. And we received some money. I believe it was from the New York State Department of Health. We had money from the FCC broadband to create our network. And the USDA is who we got our equipment from. So we created a network in our organization. It's a private, secured, encrypted network. People can come on a bridge. We can have up to 25 different places coming onto a bridge. This doesn't have to do with clinical care. But if it did have to do with clinical care, again, that network is private and it's secure. They can come in. We use Jabber software for some of it. We were using the Tamberg equipment. So there's different vendors that, you know, I'm not an IT person, so I don't always understand it, but our network is a private network, and this was the coalition that was using it. So we knew we could use teledentistry for screening, exams, urgent care, specialty care consults, any of the pre- and post-operative care on these kids, as well as distance learning and follow-up. Now, when we purchased this equipment, we purchased video monitors for all of the daycare sites, for the Eastman site, and for all of our health centers. So in terms of what the literature says, this actually has been studied by the University of Rochester. Not very many people are doing this. There's a pediatric dentist out in California that's also doing some great work with teledentistry. But what so far what the studies have said that it is very reliable, it's the same as face-to-face, it has improved access, it's feasible, it's easy to use, and it's cost-effective. The University of Rochester was using store and forward technology where they would train technicians in the daycare setting, doesn't even have to be the nurse. They could take a picture of the teeth using a special oral camera. They would upload it in a file, send it in secure email to a provider who would read the results, send the note back to the parents, what's going on, and then, you know, get the child into a dentist. Again, not very good for completion, but at least the screenings were being done. That's store and forward, where you're taking a picture, storing it, forwarding off, either through web-based or internet, secure internet. We chose to use video conferencing, live video conferencing, because we really wanted that interaction with the family, with the, you know, just to create similar to how they would go for a real-life consult. But there's pros and cons to each, are listed there. So again, we chose the live video conferencing, and as you can see, this is the equipment that's in our dental room. It's a very high-definition camera, which can be split into two or even three screens. This is our pediatric dentist in Rochester. This is our site with our interpreters and our this is actually a dental assistant we've trained to help do the exams. But, you know, the kids come in and they're right in the chairs being able to use these special cameras. This is our oral camera. It looks just like a toothbrush. And you can see that the definition of these images are just incredible. You'll have, like, moms go, oh, my God, my kid has that back in their mouth. You know, and that's a really great teaching time because you can, you know, reinforce brushing and such, because they're seeing the images on these screens. So again, in our program development phase, we worked with Eastman. We had to sign a special contract to make sure their malpractice was covering things. We worked out how we were going to pay for these things. Right now, there is no reimbursement from any insurance companies on this, so we actually use our dental revenue to pay for these consults because we know it's so important for our patients. And there's also intangible costs. When you think about costs, don't just think about the actual cost saving. You know, what is it doing for our hygienists and our dental providers who can interface with this pediatric dentist from a specialty, from a university school? I mean, there's great retention. The providers like it a lot because they feel very connected to these universities. So there's other intangible costs. You know, we were paying community health workers to drive these folks up to Rochester. They'd spend the whole day. You're paying the mileage. We'd had community health workers are getting in accidents. So there's other ways of saving costs than just the actual healthcare itself. We had to credential that pediatric dentist at Eastman on our staff. That's kind of a standard of care. We documented all the workflow, you know, referral to scheduling to appointment management to, you know, pre-visit to the paperwork. We had to get their history. Don't forget, we were Eastman way out in the country. So we had to do the Eastman thing way at our health center. So we had to get their history and exam, sign all their paperwork. We had to figure out documentation, how we were going to, we do do dummy codes because we know eventually, hopefully, this is going to be billed, and we want to be ready with the correct documentation in there for that. And of course, having our network people help us with the lines and the connectivity and such. So again, this is telepresenting. You'll see this is our hygienist here. She's actually at our daycare site. And she's presenting to the dentist in Rochester. You know, this is a four-year-old child. She's got, I see four cavities in her mouth. You know, she still sucks her thumb, whatever. She's doing that telepresenting, and the pediatric dentist is then taking the information on his clinical form. And when he does the live video consult, this is another reason we like the live video. Part of the treatment plan is observing that child's behavior, because if you can't get an x-ray, chances are you're not going to get in there and fix the cavities. So they needed to then determine what kind of sedation, whether it be oral sedation, the nitrous, or actually going to the OR. And then they could talk to the parents and such. Or they could use non-pharmacological strategies. We've had our hygienist have children with autism come into our centers and dial up the pediatric dentist, and he will actually mentor them in some behavior strategies because he specializes in kids with special needs to go through some of that. So that's been helpful as well. And then we create a registry of all those patients to follow them as they go through their treatment. Our team, which is our community health workers, our dentist, the pediatric dentist, myself, we do a monthly case conference because we have over 100 kids on our caseload right now. And they're in different phases. You know, some of them will lose their insurance, or they lose their cell phones, they're moving. Some of them are Mennonite families. You know, so they're all over the board in terms of following their social needs. And, of course, the daycares are very helpful because the children are in school every day, so you can work with the daycare nurse. So, again, every single one of these kids gets assigned a community health worker, migrant or not, community patient, English-speaking, it doesn't matter, they all get a community health worker because there are so many barriers to accessing the treatment when it comes to transportation. I'm probably preaching to the choir because you know what I'm talking about in public health with low-income families. Again, leveraging the health information technology to do the distance learning. That pediatric dentist has trained our community health worker staff on early childhood caries. So using that technology to also do learning. And, of course, our electronic health records are great because we can send telephone encounters and we can send referrals and, you know, all that. I work at home and I can say, you know, a child missed his appointment. Can you go out and do an outreach visit? So all that stuff can be done remotely. So these were our outcomes. Now we're in our fourth year of our program. We've done almost 300 consults. In terms of triaging them to the appropriate anesthesia, pretty high, 88% success rate. We've had a few children that were nitrous kids go up and they'd fail the nitrous in Rochester and then they'd have to go to the OR. That's what that triage correctly is. We've decreased travel costs and work time. Again, a lot of our families don't get paid time off for taking children to a medical appointment, so that's significant to their economic needs. We've improved the access to care, decreased time to treatment. Again, it used to take 9 months to get those kids to the OR. We are so successful in this program that actually Strong is used in a surgical center now. The Eastman School is using a standalone surgical center to do these kids. They're getting in within a month. So it's, you know, working together, seeing the rural and the urban work together and really meeting the needs of the patients, it's really been great. We've decreased our no-show rates as well as the pediatric dentist no-show rates. They run about 40%. We're running about 17% in this program. And again, that interaction between the dental staff. And that completion rate going from 15% a few years ago, now at 94% with this program. So, again, it's not necessarily the telemedicine. It's the care that you do using the telemedicine. That's a really important point to make. And that's my contact information. I'm not a dentist, but I can get in touch with our dental staff. So, any questions? What time is it? We've got still quite a bit of time. Does anybody have any questions for the other speakers? Or if anybody wants to come up to the mic and share some of the things you're doing in telemedicine, we'd love to hear them. Did this meet what you needed as far as what you were hoping to hear? Do you mind coming up to the mic or coming up here?
Colorado, and before that prescriber can indeed give somebody a prescription. Do you know if your state's working towards resolving that issue? It's something that we're working really hard on in Colorado right now. I'd love to learn from other states that I can space that too.
Yes, that's a great question. The Georgia Partnership for Telehealth has addressed this a lot, and they've done a lot of advocacy work, so they're a good resource. But in New York State, we just passed legislation that said it had to be. You have to be in relationship with that patient in order to prescribe, or it's basically professional misconduct. So where you need to go to if you're looking at this issue is your state medical practice act. That's where it defines it, and if it's not defined there, it needs to be defined. So this thing with the Xerox, I keep telling my husband, I hope they know what they're doing, because I don't see, number one, insurers paying for it, and number two, it's going to be outside of practice. But you'll have these call docs, you know, different states are using, you can call whoever, and you know, call docs, Skype, all this stuff, the technology, again, outrunning us. So you'll be very careful and know your medical.
That's a major barrier. You're trying to address a workforce issue in the first place, and then to require somebody to travel to wherever. I mean, so in Colorado, 47 of our 64 counties are rural or frontier. So we're trying to eliminate that barrier, and come with New York actually went in the opposite direction of legislation.
Right. There's a difference between, though, I think, face-to-face and telemedicine, which... That's why we credential those specialists on our staff because they're on our staff. They're in relationship with our patient. We do not, people off the street can't come in and use our telemedicine to go see the HIV provider. They have to be our primary care patient. So there is an established relationship. The other thing is the feds, we're covered by the federal tort for malpractice. And when we went to look at this malpractice, you know, they said it has to be face-to-face. Well, how do you define face-to-face? Well, we got a letter from whoever at the high level said the telemedicine was face to face. So, yeah. No, that's not for that. It's more, are you a patient of record when the treating, if you're going to a Rite Aid and you're dialing up a doctor down and hopefully they're even licensed in the same state, you know, that doesn't even know you, it's kind of like doing phone calls.
The real barrier that we're not even discussing here is rural infrastructure. And I have to change careers. I'm a telecommunications technician now. I used to be a public health nurse. And I put that equipment in. And the big companies, I won't get into the details, and I can't speak for my company, but They're not really putting out that fiber backbone to the rest of rural America. And until that happens, a lot of this is not, we can talk all we want, and we can, nothing you're saying is wrong, but it's not going to matter. And once that is in, we're going to take off like gangbusters. And just what the other thing I want to say was the natural ally here is long distance learning. And the universities that are moving to long distance learning models and really reaching out and teaching medicine and nursing through virtual practice. And those two, and what I'd like to hear, if anybody knows, is what the position of the association is, and if you know anything that's going on at the public health level, to advocacy work to make this stuff happen, because it's really a matter of cost and who's going to make money. And if they're not making money, they're not going to do it.
The other thing I want to just say is also in New York State, under Medicaid redesign team, Governor Cuomo put into place. We now are regionalized in terms of Medicaid. We have these, it's called DISRIP, something about the region and the providers in the region. And the way we're going to get paid is by outcome. It's no longer going to be fee for service. It's going to go, did your A1C go down? Did that blood pressure get better? Did they stay out of the hospital? And telemedicine is being recognized as a huge tool to help those outcomes.
Yeah, thanks. And that echo program, if you're teaching other doctors or doctors are presenting cases to doctors, then insurance doesn't pay for it, and it takes grant support to do that. But you know, there are other efficient telemedicine models, and payment remains a big barrier.
That's a good point. We participated in New York State did something similar to Hep C, this is the ECHO model, where we used somebody from Mount Sinai, hepatologist, that was precepting some of the providers in our health centers. And it, you're right, it didn't get paid for. It was a great teaching tool. But again, I like that model where the specialist, actually, you know, if you're going to pay $300 to go see a specialist and they're going to tell you, you know, whatever, you have pancreatitis. I mean, I want, if you're going to earn $300 to be in person with that person, I want that same quality of visit over my video conference if that specialist is going to bill for $300. So there's pros and cons.
But if the specialist gets $300 and teaches six primary care folks who then see five times the number of patients, then maybe that's more efficient.
Yeah, very good point. They're also using ML geriatrics. But then again, I'm speaking of the primary care provider, it's like, oh, we're being asked to be dermatologists, geriatricians. I mean, you know, there's just so much that we can do as well. But I agree with you, the model, the person should be reimbursed nonetheless, but the health center probably need to sign a contract saying they'll give that guy some money. How are you over time?
Yeah, I'm Nancy Warren. I'm from University of California, San Francisco, and we actually run it's not ECHO, but everybody wants to call it ECHO. It's a tele-education, virtual learning community, whatever you want to call it, case consultation with HIV providers. We are going out, reaching out to people in primary care settings in rural areas in Arizona, Nevada, and you know, people think of California usually as Los Angeles and San Francisco, but we have vast areas of frontier and super, uber rural areas where nobody is. So we're doing that, and I agree there's a huge cost issue. There's also a huge connectivity issue with getting to some of those health centers that have very, very poor wireless or whatever it is they have. It's very difficult for them to connect. And I think there is also the issue that, you know, sometimes people can't even get to the larger places, so you really do need, I hear what you're saying, and this is what we hear from our providers too, that it's hard, they can't be the expert of everything, but on the other hand, if you're in the middle of nowhere and all the other people are in the middle of some of these desert places is really few people, and so what are they supposed to do, you know? So I'm interested in hearing, because you talked about this, how easy was it for you to engage providers in other settings to be a part of these tele-education efforts? You talked about that earlier. We've had a difficult time with that as well, keeping people engaged, getting release time from clinics. We're just about to get cut off of our HRSA grant, so now we have to just keep it going on air. So I don't know.
Yeah, you really need to find a champion in that specialty setting. I don't know how we found them. We have one of our telemedicine directors that works in administration. His wife's a physician at one of the large university hospitals, and they know like everyone. So I think he kind of was just talking, and it was all through these relationships we had built, basically, that we were able to do providers, though not necessarily educators. So so it's finding the champion providers. A lot of the people coming out of med school now are so tech savvy. They've had even experiences in telemedicine. We had our ENT specialist, you know, was in the Navy, and he was doing consults out onto the ships. So they're out there. So we just somehow got to do that networking through the medical provider organizations. But that's kind of how we did it. Yes, again, we feel that that's a recruitment tool for our, that she asked if our providers are going to release time. Right now, yeah, and they're on, everybody's on a productivity because everybody's hurting for money. But we feel that our providers love that connection so much, and they've gotten so good at it. After a year of taking care of complicated ADHD kids, or after a year of taking care of HIV folks, guess what? They are becoming just as savvy, and they're doing the annual pass now. So it's so it's such a good attention tool for them. We feel that's a great investment. It's the learning that can occur during the consult. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like, you know, when you talk about transportation into a health center, our Geneva site, you know, is right in the center of Geneva. It's a small urban area, and they can't come 2 miles to the appointment. There's no transportation. They don't bus. I mean, there's like very little transportation, even in the rural smaller cities, if you will. So that community health worker model, going to them, I don't know what the answer is. We have to work really hard on case management to get them in, using the resources in the community for transportation as a barrier.
Hi, I'm Jill Krieger. I'm an attorney at the Network for Public Health Law, and I kind of came to this issue. We've been doing quite a bit of work on oral health, access to oral health care, and kind of came to telehealth, telemedicine by that route. And I know you just mentioned you're from California. I'm pretty confident that it was California that this year passed a law to allow Medicaid reimbursement for teledentistry. And after some pilot programs on virtual dental homes. So if anyone wants help tracking down that California bill, just I'd be happy to exchange contact information. And then the other question I had was, and I apologize, I missed some of the first sessions, but I don't know if there was any discussion of video direct observed therapy or TB. And I was wondering if that might be an application, because we're getting lots of questions about, you know, just the same kinds of benefits that you get from telehealth in other contexts, but video DOT particularly would be relevant to public health.
It's funny you should mention that, because we had a patient that was on directly observed therapy in one of the counties we work with, public health there. She wanted to go on vacation in Florida for 2 weeks. And we were like, how do we do this? We gave her an iPad, she came on our network, secure, she dialed into our network through the iPad, and they did the directly observed therapy with the iPad and through the interphone. So it's doable. I think that would be great. The other thing I want to say, just so you know, there's telehealth resource centers in each of the regions of the U.S., and there's CTEL, which is the law. There's a specialist that the national organizations have funded, HRSA funded these resource centers, and then I think it's CTEL. And your resource center should be able to find it for you that talks about the law, malpractice, and all that stuff in telemedicine. And there's also some equipment. Another organization that will help you find equipment, like they rate the reliability of the different vendors. But if you were to just Google the Telehealth Resource Center, and there'll be ones that come up for your area of the country, and then they're great resources that can connect you to any kind of program development.
My name is Roger Villalonga, and I work at ACOG. Just a quick question, maybe from the provider end. If anyone has any experience, I know with telemedicine and telehealth and virtual teams, when we talk about regional care and regionalization of the healthcare, it's beyond just state lines in some cases, especially in the really rural community. So just from a provider perspective, if anyone has any thoughts on challenges in terms of scope of practice or liability once you cross state lines for different provider types, or perceived challenges with liability or resistance from providers because they don't want to be liable for their work if they have sort of different standards within different states or among different states.
I can speak a little bit to that. If you're looking at doing a program, you need to have a physician license in your state or a provider in your state. See, if the patient's residing in Pennsylvania, then they need to see a provider from Pennsylvania. They can't cross into New York for that, unless the New York provider's license in Pennsylvania. The other thing is to check the malpractice, because we had we couldn't do ENT after a while because his private physician, ENT specialist, his malpractice told him they would drop him if he continued to do telemedicine consults. That was MilMac. It was the insurance. insurance provider, which is very common in our area. So again, there's been a lot of legislation, there's been a lot of political push to get these insured, malpractice insurers to get to pay for this, but you really need to, if you're a provider, you gotta check, make sure you're covered.
Physician providers, but you know, advanced practice nurses or any providers that less physician providers probably than and more clinical providers that aren't recognized among all 50 states and have sort of different pushbacks among states, just their approach and thought, where they might be able to practice in one state but not another or practice independently.
Chance to share and hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Your time in New Orleans.